Welcome to the SIS Off the Charts Football Podcast. I am your host, Bryce Rossler, and I am joined this week by my SIS colleagues, Alex Vigderman and Matt Manicharian.
You didn't call me disgraced former host this time.
Yeah, but everybody knows your notoriety now precedes you. So it's just, and you've got to hard stop it in 48 minutes. So I wanted to just get straight into the content. This is sort of Alex's baby. So I'll let Alex preface the discussion because as our viewers know, I like to be carried. So Alex, take it away.
Well, it's probably, I would say it's Matt's baby, but he was very busy this week. So I had to speaking of carrying things. So
you're my surrogate?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I'm your Phoebe. So the idea started from this being a draft class where particularly the wide receiver and offensive tackle positions are viewed as pretty deep. And that could mean a handful of different things, but at least in the way that most people are probably thinking about it, it's about having like a pretty wide collection of players who could be taken in the first round that people feel really good about. And then also having some depth behind that, but certainly in the way that people usually talk about and think about the draft, it's really that like first round talent, so to speak, and it being particularly good at those two positions. But also, especially when it comes to receivers, we've talked in the last few years about there being an increase in just like the number of quality players that are coming out every year. And does the fact that we feel like the true like depth all the way down the draft at some positions is better than it might have been in the past, does that affect the way that you want to approach your selections in the first round? If you feel like you could potentially get quality fourth round receivers, does that mean that you don't want, I mean, maybe not, maybe those like, you know, blue chip type players don't enter into this conversation, but the guys that you would normally potentially take at the back end of the first round, does that make you potentially want to go a different way? So I kind of want to get Matt's temperature on the sort of topic in general before we go into any more detail.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a pretty detailed lead off. So like basically what we're talking about is a combination of positional value or the positional value in the context of scarcity and how much that scarcity at a position should or shouldn't matter, both within the context of the NFL at that position group and within the context of the current draft. So what this whole conversation starts with and is best informed by is the horizontal draft board. So anybody, you know, if you got your phone or computer in front of you and you can go to the 3013.com and pull up the draft board, it's literally meant to look like the horizontal boards with the old magnets that we used to have that are now all digitized. It's our version. It's our grades on the players. But what it does is it changes the narrative from the public narrative, which is often about the vertical rankings of the players, right? How many Odunze versus neighbors arguments can we have? How many neighbors versus Harrison arguments can we have, right? As opposed to that, what teams are actually looking at is, okay, we have similar grades on these players. Now, how do I decide amongst them on what we call the horizontal board? So, you know, picture a big matrix. And if you can, like I said, pull it up. Because what you always learn from the horizontal board is that when you get to the later rounds of the draft, when you get to day three on the draft, there are going to be players at certain positions like running back and receiver where there are guys that are draftable late. And there are certain positions like tackle and corner where those are going to dry up really fast. And if you don't pick your guys by the end of the second day, you might have nobody that you're really high on. And you might actually be picking amongst players that you have graded low, as opposed to where if you can be a little bit more patient at some of these deeper positions, there might just be somebody sitting there that you had a higher grade on later in the draft. So that's like where this all starts. But yeah, where do we go from there? Bryce, you know, take us home.
I think we've got a long ways to go to get home, but this conversation is sort of related to drafting for need versus best player available.
But can I cut you off on there? Because again, I think that's the way that the public looks at it is need versus best player available. I think hopefully everybody at this point in the NFL, but certainly the people that are thinking about this, what I would consider the right way in the NFL, are thinking about best player available combined with positional scarcity. I really don't think that you can be drafting based on, I need a left tackle right now, so I have to get in position to draft a left tackle. I know that like works in people's brains well. And when you're like reading a draft magazine or whatever else, like that's a very sensible thing to do as a fan. I get it. I've done it. But when you're actually in the room, what you want to make sure you're doing is prioritizing the quote unquote money positions, right? That's really what you need to do, because if you don't get tackles and corners in the first 2 days of the draft, it's just very, very difficult to find them. There just aren't a lot of dudes that play later in the draft from there. So to me, the whole need versus best player available, need is like in third place after best place available and scarcity.
I think I get what you're saying about the outside perception being different from what happens, but I would argue that some teams still do draft primarily on need. And I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but we know that teams err, and it definitely happens.
When you say primarily, do you mean across the full range of the draft or more at like the top end?
So when I say primarily, I it's a bit of a misnomer, because I'm not trying to say that philosophically that's what they're doing. I'm talking about within the context of a single pick, that there are...
If you're a good team like the Eagles, you realize that your needs are always quarterback, offensive line, and defensive line. And if you're a bad team, you run around trying to fill holes on your roster as opposed to prioritizing the best player available. The best player available does incorporate scarcity. Like, we have a higher grade on Marvin Harrison Jr. this year. That doesn't mean I would take him ahead of Caleb Williams. Like, we have to understand, even if the grade's a little bit higher on Harrison than it is on Williams, Williams is a quarterback. Like, that's half of your offense, right? Like,
that's fine. I get that. I just took issue with this idea that teams are not drafting for need.
I think at their best, they're not.
I would agree.
You're right that they do. And I would argue that works out less often.
I would also say that the error bars around our evaluation of the quality of players is probably wider than our error bars of like our understanding of the strengths of a roster. So like, if you're not often in a situation in which there's like a very clear distinction between quality.
I'm going to cut you off real quick. When you say R, who are you?
Sure. So the decision makers, I would say.
Well, yeah, that makes sense, right? Because like, you would hope that a team is better in its self-evaluation than it is of prospects.
Right. And so what I'm getting to there is like, yes, we want best player available, but it's very rare that you would actually have, like, there might be only a couple times in a whole draft where there's like a clear best player available compared to the players at other positions and whatever, right? There's just pretty big error bars there. So yes, you could observe teams.
Which
taking.
By the way, is the design of how we do it, right? You'll see people that put in like precise decimals for things like in a way that we don't. And the reason for that is because we're trying to trust the horizontal board and not need everybody to be aligned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but be able to see, okay, here's this tier of players, here's this tier of players, and then distinguishing based on more information.
Yeah, and basically that more information, it could be roster construction, right? And
my point is that it's positional roster construction as opposed to need-based roster construction, and there's a tiny distinction there.
Okay.
Maybe not tiny.
But I do think that the we might observe something that looks like drafting for need, but what it really is that like need in quotes was like the fourth thing on the list and the other things were all basically a wash.
Yeah. There's a psychological game that also people play where when they see the need, they pump up all the other reasons in their mind probably. I think that definitely happens.
That and so the Bears need a quarterback and Caleb Williams is available to them and they're going to draft Caleb Williams.
Right. That all the teams move in one direction.
Yeah. That is not something I would say like, oh, this team is drafting for need. Drafting for need is a derogatory term. When I think of a team as...
So you're saying forsaking things pointing in a different direction, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would think of drafting for need like taking a second round tackle prospect in at 17 because you feel you need a tackle. This is just a made up example, but
right.
That's how I would characterize that.
Yeah. And I would say that it's probably at the, I would say at this point that happens relatively rarely. And of course, we like after the first couple of rounds, like our ability, like any of that kind of goes out the window, right? Like eval, the range of talent and uncertainty and all that stuff goes like way wider towards the end of the draft, where somebody could take a player in like the third or fourth round that somebody else might have had a, you know, an undrafted grade or whatever on.
Sure.
So like that kind of stuff will absolutely happen outside of the first couple rounds. And I don't think anybody really bat an eye at it. But the example you gave is I think a good one of there are fairly clearly by your own measures, right? By your own grades, you have a player who is inferior that you're taking because there's a hole in your roster that you perceive.
I want to go back to what Matt said about there being like subconscious psychological components which create inflated evaluations for players, because I think at least in the media sphere, we see this. I think that people wanting certain positions to be good, specifically with quarterback this year, I think we see it quite a bit, is people want quarterbacks to be good. So there is hype around players like, say, Michael Penix Jr., Bo Nix, as first-round quarterbacks, when I think that is generous.
I think, yeah, and I think that's what I might characterize that at, is like they want teams to be good, right? Everybody wants, and there was all this commentary about like the quality of quarterback play being inferior potentially this year and maybe last year as well. And so people kind of just want like the NFL to be good. And so they want the quarterbacks to fill in the spots and teams that don't, like, I think the quarterback is probably subject to this like way more than anybody else.
I agree, but I wonder if a similar phenomenon exists for teams where we are really hoping that this position is good, or we are going to inflate our grades of a certain position because we need it. Kenny Pickett, I think, would be a good example of this. All the quarterbacks were bad that year. There probably wasn't a guy that, there definitely wasn't a guy that should have been drafted in the first round.
Yeah.
But they needed a quarterback because everybody needs a quarterback. And so
people are interested in getting a rookie quarterback on that deal for a lot of reasons and stuff. But so quarterbacks, I think, have to be like their own category a little bit. But
right.
Certainly, like, my opinion is, why everybody's like, why are NFL teams so bad at drafting quarterbacks? I'm like, because there aren't 32 good ones. If there are 32 good ones, then we wouldn't be overdrafting them all the time because we know how important the need is. And every team would have a good quarterback and we'd all just be happy, ho-hum, we all have our own Mahomes. But like, there aren't 32 good ones. And so teams that don't have one are going to keep over-investing resources because they need to fill that position. So I think that's why these guys get pushed up at that position specifically. That is scarcity, though, again.
It's scarcity. But I want to refocus you on the question at hand. Do you have any examples from your time in the league where you felt a player was being, that his grade was being inflated, or the perception of him was more favorable than it should have been out of either like a desperation for the position itself, or when I say a desperation for the position itself, like the team has a need there, or because it's a position of scarcity? Do you have any anecdotal examples you can give of this?
Well, I mean, positions of scarcity, I mean, look at the positions that get drafted in the first round the most, right? Like, receiver is an interesting one because it's kind of gone a different way recently, but like generally, like, a big part of the reason why you want quarterbacks, tackles, pass rushers, and corners is because they are more scarce. Now, receivers are interesting because in the passing league, the NFL, it's become something where having an elite receiver, it's almost like different than just having a receiver. It can sort of take your, it can unlock Tua, for example. It can really take your offense to another level. So I think that position, as it's gained in importance and in salaries along with it too, has also been interesting because it's not the scarce position. Right? Like, running backs have suffered from, everybody can find running backs, they're a dime a dozen, but receivers have it. Maybe in like the lower tier, but on the high tier, receiver salaries keep going up. To me, that's interesting because if you like look at the league right now compared to where it was 5 years ago. Receiver play is a lot better. There's a lot more depth, and there are a lot more of these players that I think can elevate an offense. So how much do you continue pushing those guys up and prioritizing that like true number one type ceiling versus you could find receivers that can play later?
So when you talk about the receivers that can play later, how far back do you feel like we need to go to find like a different, like how long has this been true?
Always that you can find receivers late. They haven't developed as quickly, right? It used to be you needed to wait until like a third season for a receiver to really develop. Now with spread camps and 7-on-7s going all year in Texas and Florida, people come in kind of more ready, it seems, on the NFL level in that sort of way to contribute right away.
I'm partially asking just because we've been doing a little bit of sort of exploration of, and we're going to do hopefully more of this in probably the next year or so, of exploring our own scouting process. And now that we have, you know, what, 6 drafts or so, and seeing what the texture of prospects is and that sort of thing. And we don't see, like you were saying, like a number of players who can play. That number's been pretty static over the last 6 years, basically. But we actually don't have, like, there were years, 2019, maybe 2020, something like that, where the number of guys who were at more of that like starter or sort of like fringe starter grade, that was higher than it is this year. But it gets, and then gets filled out by the guys who are what we would view as like a 6.0 type grade or 6.2. So that's sort of the reason why I was getting at the question of how common this was going back, because I think we have the perception that receivers have become over the last few years much more prominent, and we understand their value to be greater than even 5-10 years ago. But we're not seeing like some crazy trend within the last handful of drafts, at least.
Okay, but I mean, over the course of time, I'm not saying about this year,
sure,
but over the course of time, two things have happened. Number one, there are more high quality receivers in the NFL now, I would argue, than there were before. I'm not sure exactly how you would measure that.
I suppose that that's necessarily true because there's just more 11 personnel now than there was 20 years ago or whatever, right? There that third receiver is getting on the field way more often.
And I think along with that, I think what's led to that for me has been that receiver development has become much better. Receivers are better now than they were in a lot of ways. Their skills are much more refined. Their hands are better.
This goes back to high school level. Like, you have the proliferation of 7-on-7 leagues that have been a thing for a decade plus. It trickles up.
Right, and they grow up and they're better. So along with that, though, we could say that offensive line development's gotten worse, right, in the spread football era. So the sort of opposite's been true over the course of time from the NFL side, where generally it's much thinner in terms of the starter level players that you're finding on a year-to-year basis. Now I'm waiting for Alex to tell me that's actually not true.
No, so and no, I think that's basically been true. And in this year, I think if we look at the class, you can kind of see on the horizontal draft board that you do end up like the grades for the tackles, like there's more guys towards that top end compared to the receivers. Like the total number of players might be comparable, but the distribution in that sort of like medium to upper medium class, you know, middle to upper middle class, skews higher on the tackles and skews lower on the receivers. The belly is a bit bigger on the receiver distribution.
So I mean, we got 5 basically like first round grade-ish. We don't do round based grading, but we have like 5 at each position.
Right. So but at that like tier, like the guys right below are more tackles, and then the guys below that are more receivers.
Right. But that has to do with the way that we value the players on our grading scale. So there's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing going on here too, where we're grading these players based on what they're going to be in today's NFL. So I would say based on that, in 2024, it's more difficult to be a high graded receiver than it was, say, in 2015. Whereas at tackle, I don't think that's true. In fact, the opposite might be true, because it's gotten more and more scarce while receivers gotten better and better. And at a certain point, you know, I don't know how you choose between optimizing your roster, between accentuating the positives or minimizing the negatives, sort of. But I think it's interesting to think about.
One thing I looked at as prep for this show that I'm kind of curious if you guys have an opinion on is the sort of breakdown of the draft capital spent on players, not necessarily draft capital, but just like the number of players selected compared to the number of guys who play, because that should be roughly corresponding to each other. Like we can't look at the total number of the total amount of draft capital spent on receivers and compare it to quarterbacks or whatever, because, or no, quarterbacks is a bad example, compare it to centers or safeties or whatever, because there's just like more receivers who play, right? So correspondingly, there should be more drafted. That sort of makes sense. But there are some sort of funky relationships between the draft number of guys who are taken and the number of guys who play, where there are more receivers taken than play. There are fewer tackles taken than play. There are way more running backs taken than play. Or I should say, there are way more running backs taken than there are snaps given to running backs. Those might be distributed among multiple players, but like the total amount of running back snaps is meaningfully smaller than the number of players taken to fill those. First of all, does that sound like a reasonable heuristic for how we should be, like, should teams roughly be mapping their draft picks to the usage of those players, or is it not really relevant?
I mean, this is a classic, it depends. Because depending on the position, you're going to rotate them or not rotate them. So like part of the argument for taking a corner over a pass rusher is that the corner is always going to be on the field. But like if you have an elite pass rusher, then probably always want that guy on the field too. So you get into a splitting hairs thing. And then like running backs are a great example of a position where the snap counts being different are kind of what's interesting there. Like you want to build your roster to have an optimal number of players at each position to be able to deploy them, you know, on Sundays. But also within that, there's different numbers of snaps that you could reasonably expect different positions to take. Like we just don't see running backs getting 60 snaps a game anymore, but we see plenty of players at other positions do that.
Yeah, I suppose running back is a funky example for that sort of reason. And they also get, I suppose, a disproportionate amount of like focus. Like they're arguably closer to quarterbacks in terms of when they're involved, they're very involved. And that affects their risk and
yeah, the best argument for running back value, I don't know, maybe the best argument is receiving value, but the other one is they got the ball in the hands a lot.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, I was most curious because we were talking about the receiver tackle thing, I was most curious about the fact that it seems like there's more draft capital attributable to receivers relative to the amount they play, and there's less given to tackles. Well, although I guess the tackle thing makes some sense because that's a position you're definitely not rotating much, right? So those guys are in an ideal world, you're picking a guy and you're sitting in there. So theoretically, you don't necessarily need to throw a bunch of players at the problem.
So, Bryce, I want to go back to something you asked me earlier that I didn't fully answer because I'm distracted by things that none of us could have accounted for right now. You asked about if I had to think of specific examples. And so I actually two examples came to mind with the Saints. So Cameron Jordan, to me, was an example of us properly valuing the position that we wanted him to play, specifically in that defense, having sort of that left defensive end role, right? Like guy, the strong side defensive end generally. And that was a good example, in my opinion, of positional value dictating where we were on the board and then us behaving rationally. When we drafted Patrick Robinson, the corner, I think he was a first round also, maybe he was high second, but I think he was first round also. That was a need pick. That was like, oh God, we don't have any corners that can play press man and we want to play press man. So let's draft this corner, even though we know he's not really everything that we're looking for in terms of being like the best graded player right now overall, like across the board. That was more like, yeah, we really need this, so let's hope it works out with this guy.
You drafted 32nd overall, so almost second. I want to shift a little bit. I would like to push back just a teeny bit on the notion of tackle scarcity. I acknowledge that the general consensus is that offensive line development is at a low point. I also think that, practically speaking, there is scarcity there, but how much of this is overstated because all the edge players now are freaks and their job and the job of an offensive tackle is just getting harder? with having to pass set on a higher percentage of plays. Like there's probably some gap between what our perception of the general skill at that position is and what it actually is, just because of some extrinsic factors there.
That's totally legit. And to be clear, I'm not as critical of development and stuff like that. Like, listen, if you're coaching a college team and you're trying to win games and that involves passing on 90% of plays, and like, try to win games. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. Obviously, you want to develop players too, but the primary objective at that level is to win. As you get to the NFL, therefore, you might just have different skills that require refinement than the ones that have been put on play. Just the same reason why, like I said, it used to be 3 years for receivers to develop, because a lot of guys weren't reading coverages on the run and having the ability to do that the way that they can now because of how they're trained on it for so much longer. But like, I think that you're right that like defensive line athletes are absolute freaks of nature, and therefore we need absolute freaks of nature to be able to counteract them. And I would go further to say that, to me, I probably agree that it's a little bit more overstated with tackles compared to interior guys, because there's also the thought process of like, you can find interior guys, but like not that can handle Aaron Donald. So I do agree with like some of your pushback.
Well, I don't know that you want to measure I don't think you want to measure it by can you handle Aaron Donald, because you only run into,
he's retired.
Well, yeah, but just in general, the idea of can you handle,
I guess, what do you want me to mention?
Yeah, I guess the question is, should that be your measurement? The can you handle the top of the top freak level guys, or just like the median?
Well, that's not how we grade. We grade based on how you perform against. We don't use the word average because it has negative connotations, but how do you perform against an average starting NFL player?
Right. Can you win on that level? And yeah, so there are key distinctions here. And I do want to be clear. If I could choose, I'm probably choosing tackles over guards because those guys are playing out on an island more. It's harder to give them help in certain things. But at the same time, the extent to which left tackle is different than right tackle and left guard is different from right tackle and all the value, like you need five good ones, probably more than that, because somebody's going to get injured, or maybe many of them are going to get injured. So to me, it's these giant people that are really great athletes, the ones that are 280 pounds and running 4.4 at edge rusher, or the ones that are 320 pounds and 6'8" and can actually have a chance of blocking those guys at offensive tackle. These rare physical skill sets, to me, are maybe, I would say, like the primary driver of why they should be drafted higher. It is that those skill sets are rare to find in human beings. And so I'm of the opinion that outside of quarterback, you've got to go really hard on that. And maybe now more than ever, because of the way that receiver talent has sort of exploded.
So I'm very compelled by this idea of the extrinsic factors affecting tackles specifically. And we can ring the bell of Alex is going to bring in a baseball analogy. This feels sort of like the problem that, so the idea of there's only one tackle, he's playing the whole game because you want to have continuity on the offensive line, and he's facing a rotating cavalcade of freaks that he has to contend with. And that feels like a hitter trying to contend with a rotating cavalcade of freaks coming out of the bullpen. And there's a different conversation that's happening in baseball right now in terms of pitchers getting hurt because that's a thing that is the best way to win, so to speak. But anyway, this feels similar to that, where it's like you're just naturally at a disadvantage because of the way that roster construction works and the way that the teams are collecting talent. You have constantly fresh, crazy athletes that are coming at this one single person who has to be able to hold up against that, basically. And that's a tough job. So I do totally buy that those factors would contribute to you need to try and find the tippy top guys because they're facing essentially, like if you sort of, you know, squish together all of the edge rushers into one person, like that person is an elite edge rusher, but it's actually being split among three, four guys.
So I want to get back to this tippy top conversation because I think it's a really good one. You did make me think something else there, which is to play a devil's advocate on myself. We could say a lot of the same things we're saying about tackles. We could say them about corners, right? I just got done talking about how receivers have gotten so good.
Sure.
It's really hard to find corners that can play man against Jamar Chase, right? Justin Jefferson, like these types of players. So I think that exists too. What's not true there is, listen, corners are like 5'11", 190. They got to be fast, you know, as you could be. But, you know, speed training's really good these days. And like people that size exist in a way that that tackles don't. But going back to like the tippy top, in basketball, you care much more about upside than sort of like the expected path of the player, right? Like the nature of that is you have to have one of the best players in the league on your team. Right. And so the chance at that is more valuable than actually like the expected contribution, which is another different wrinkle for football, I think.
I'm going to make some shit up real quick, and you guys can tell me whether or not you think it's a valid thought. But obviously the passing game has exploded over the last 20 years. And I think Matt, because he's a boomer, would know better than I would if I'm
Harry Truman.
If this is Jesus. But I would imagine that the variety in terms of player archetypes that corners have to face is greater than it was 20 years ago, because these passing attacks have grown and they're more diverse across the league. So teams have their preferred flavors of receivers. So you have, in aggregate, a larger skill set you have to contend with as a corner.
Yeah, I think that's true. And like all the ways that people are sort of like manufacturing offense have to do with that. Because, listen, it goes back to like early in my days, I was taught you want to build your receiver room like a basketball team. So you want to have your point guard types, Wes Welker getting in and out of breaks. You want to have your sort of like wing type players that can play on the outside and be your traditional sort of like X receiver. You want to have your tight end to be your big five hanging in the post, able to help you get that. So like there was very much like a league like that where it was like, you're an X skill set, you're a Y skill set, and you're a Z skill set. And then all of a sudden, over the course of the last years, we're like, oh, wow, if we have this 6'7" guy and we line him up at the X, then all of a sudden, their corner, who's optimized to play against, you know, fast vertical threat receivers, is matched up against somebody that's 8 inches taller than him. All of those sorts of things, I agree. So, like, versatility is at a premium, certainly for that reason. Again, it's just like basketball. On defense, you want to be as versatile as you can possibly be, right? I want to be able to guard 1 through 5. That's the most valuable thing I can have at that sort of. And then on offense, I just want to have the most maximum level of whatever skill I have that's possible, right? Like I want to be Tyreek Hill level speed. I want to be Jimmy Graham level catch radius. Like it's sort of that. It's the same sort of relationship, except that NFL players don't have to play on both offense and defense.
I guess that makes sense. And the edge rusher thing sort of flips it on its head, because the edge rusher is not necessarily like reacting, right? They're rushing, so to speak. And so
they're the wide receiver.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The offensive tackle. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of thing. You have that extreme skill set there, and the tackle might need to be a bit more reactive and be able to handle the extreme skill set.
And the other thing corners have going against them is the governance. I think that the way the game is called is not very advantageous for defense. So, and I think that is, I don't know if the penalty figures for like the last 5 years would actually reflect this. So could be wrong, but I feel like that's amplified by things like defensive holding and defensive pass interference. And you have a greater opportunity for missteps than you do as an edge rusher.
Yeah. For example. And I'll take that a step further. The history of the NFL over like 100 years, even before it was the NFL, right? The AAFL and stuff like that. Going all the way back, the history of the league is defenses figure out ways to catch up to offenses and make their lives miserable. And then we change the rules to favor offense. And then defenses catch up again. And then we change the rules to favor offense. You can see, I mean, this plays out like almost on a yearly basis over the last 20 years, like the hip drop tackle. The next thing that defenders have to contend with, sort of like, how do I bring a guy down without getting called for that penalty if I'm in a not great situation, you know, where I can't run through the guy. But you can look through this in terms of illegal contact penalties. You can go all the way back to the literal forward pass. That's why the forward pass was invented. They were tired of 0-0 ties.
Speaking of boomers.
It's interesting to think about, though. if you trust history that like to at least run, if not repeat, then understanding like why did defenses have such a good year last year in the NFL? There's a lot of precedent for defenses figuring out the sort of current context of the league and it requiring there to be another sort of legislative change, a change in governance, as Bryce would say, in order for the offense to have the next move. We just see that so rapidly now because Tom Brady gets a lot of rule changes.
If only we had a podcast where we talked about the defensive metagame in football.
We did some.
We could refer to. Yeah. Is the hip drop tackle the new patch that causes a change, or is that not big enough?
I don't think it's
in the NFL. It's been like a lot of little things like that.
Yeah.
Like the major, like the safety things, I think certainly favor the offense all over the place. Like just keeping the quarterbacks on the field, it also favors the product generally.
Sure.
Is that I told you there aren't 32 good ones. If you start getting injured, it gets pretty thin pretty fast, like we saw past couple of years. So there's reasoning for it. And the NFL is always optimizing on what they think the optimal points per game is and the optimal time of game is and things like that. That's what the officials and the competition committee are looking at. They're a little bit more like the Fed now, raising and lowering interest rates with the rules than they are like just making big sweeping legislative changes like they used to do in the 70s and 80s.
These changes are small, but they're also cumulative.
Right.
So to relate this to esports, for example,
yeah.
In Dota, what happens is every so often there are big patches. But what generally happens is over the course of a couple small patches, a hero gets small buffs and then they get another small buff in like a third patch. And then all of a sudden they're broke.
I'm broken. What's a small buff?
A little improvement in their ability to perform.
Yeah.
You got to say with Riz, though, huh?
So,
oh, brother.
Like the hip drop tackle isn't, it's not big, but these things add up.
Yeah.
And
so where's the aiming zone on the quarterback right now, right? It's not just the helmet. It's not just the goal line rule. But if it's like, okay, and now I can't land on him either. Like, well, what?
Yeah. Yeah, in a vacuum, these things are not significant in and of themselves. But when coupled with other tackling elements, you start to create a problem.
Well, and the other thing I suppose that exists in football that doesn't exist in video games is like the uncertainty about like exactly what you're saying, like where can I hit? Like that thought process has to happen for the defensive players in a way that just like it gets programmed out of the video game, right? Things become impossible. Whereas this is like you're just going to get penalized, so you're constantly like trying to figure out what can I do that's legal.
Yes. Always buffing.
I mean, it's the NFL, so yes.
This discussion ended up being a lot more abstract and free-flowing than I thought it would be, given Alex's frame. Alex, do you want to run through any numbers? Because you did some research into the question of scarcity. Did you find anything compelling that you would love to share with our viewership?
Honestly, not crazy compelling, which is why I'm not bothered about the way that the conversation went. I think, in general, we are not seeing some like huge change, at least within the scope of the years that we're talking about. Like we have data on drafts and that sort of thing for only the last 6 years. So like if we're talking about comparing to the early 2000s and that sort of thing, that's just like a different NFL in a lot of ways. And so it's not necessarily fair to compare that way.
It's a different patch.
Yeah. I would say it's like Dota versus Dota 2. So that stuff, you don't really see a lot of a difference over the last handful of years. And then from draft class to draft class, you'll see different peaks and valleys of players. You know, that top starter quality player, there's maybe fewer of them at wide receiver than there were a handful of years ago, but that might happen totally differently next year. Like, that's not necessarily a trend. Apropos of the cornerback conversation, one thing I did find was that, like, cornerback performance in the first 2 years has been, like, pretty good all the way down the draft. So that position has been more successful than I think people might be giving credit for. The tough thing is that they're just crazy variable, right?
Yeah.
So
a lot of stuff to consider: scarcity, upside, floor. Yeah, all of these things.
And while you might not be like drafting for need, so to speak, your needs
contribute to which players make it on the field in the first year. And your opportunities are affected by the state of the roster around you, even if the draft pick isn't necessarily. So the way that we like evaluate players is they have to be on the field, and there is more opportunity in some cases based on roster construction. And so that you hope that that balances out over the course of the whole league if you're trying to analyze positional performance. But Jordan Love is, quote, a bust from the first couple of years of his performance. Right? That kind of stuff. That's an extreme version, obviously.
We take those L's.
Yeah.
All right. That's as good a point to end on as any. For my colleagues, Alex Friedman, the disgraced Matt Manoogian, and our executive producer, Justin Stein, I am Bryce Rosser. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Off the Charts Football Podcast.
Goodbye. I'm sorry I was a disgrace today.